Today we'll be tackling the subject of social media in the public sector. It's a subject that you see in the media reasonably regularly, but despite the risks, social media can offer us some great opportunities for public sector to connect, particularly in a digital by default model, which is what we're moving to. Today we'll look at how we can promote a healthy social media culture within the public service through a better understanding of what we do. We'll start with Mia Garlick, who is currently the head of policy at Facebook Australia. She's served as assistant secretary in the Department of Broadband Communications and Digital Economy, with roles in Creative Commons and Google as well along the way. Craig Tomler, he'll be up next, and he's a globally recognised Government 2.0 advocate and managing director of Delib Australia. Prior to this, he spent almost 6 years in the public service, leading digital initiatives in the departments of Human Services, Health and Regional Australia. And finally, we have John Sheridan, who joined the APS in 2002 after 22,000 years. John oversaw the ARC project for the Australian government. He joined the Australian Public Service in 2002 after 22 years with the Australian Army and 3 years with the Defence Science and Technology Organisation. In the Australian Government Information Management Organisation, AGIMO, John led the whole of government initiatives including AustraliaGov.au, Data Centre Strategy and Telecommunication Services. In February 2013, John became the first Australian Government Chief Technology Officer.
Thanks, George, and hi, everyone, and thanks for coming out today. So I wanted to sort of open up, and hopefully it's not too basic for everyone. It's always difficult at events like this to sort of know if we're talking about the baseline, like what is social media and why should people in government engage on social media, or whether we're talking about page posting best practice, organic reach, and how to draft your comments policy. I can talk about all of them, but I thought I'd start out, given I'm sort of opening and trying to lead out for James and John. I thought I'd just sort of talk generally sort of about the concept of what is social media and why social media for government agencies. And I think the really important thing to be thinking about is to be acknowledging that how people get their information is changing. Increasingly, they're getting it from social media on a phone. There's a large number of stats around this. One example is in the 2012 US presidential election. The Mitt Romney campaign did a survey of Ohio and found that 2 million swing voters, 2 million voters in the swing state of Ohio weren't watching live TV. So if they were running ads and they wanted to make sure that this key group were seeing them, they had to use amplification strategies across a range of different channels, including platforms like Facebook. The ACMA, for example, does lots of great research about how people are using technology here in Australia. They've found that nearly 3 million Australians don't have a landline anymore. Everybody's moving on the phone. You guys would see it yourself when you get on the bus in the morning, is that most people are reading the news on this device. So then the question, and if you talk to media organisations, for example, you'll see that they're seeing an increase in referral traffic from social media platforms, because increasingly this is how people are getting their news and information. Some of you might know the Pew Research Institute in the US. They did a State of the News Media 2014 report, and this was one of the quotes which I thought was really interesting. The year 2014 brought more evidence than ever that news is part of the explosion of social media and mobile devices, and in that way could offer the opportunity to reach more people with news than ever before. Half of Facebook users get news there even though they did not go there looking for it, and the Facebook users who get news at the highest rates are 18 to 24-year-olds. So just in terms of Facebook as a platform, given I work there, I thought I would share some insights about it. There are 13 million Australians who are active on Facebook. That's an increase from 12 million last year. And when we say active, it's not like that email account that you set ages ago and then you forgot the password. It's people who are active at least once a month on the platform. We've got 9.8 million Australians connecting daily via Facebook. But the really interesting thing about all of these stats is the percentage who are doing it on a phone. So 8.5 million of the people who are accessing Facebook daily are doing so on a mobile device. Now, often when I tell people the big numbers that are associated with social media, they say, "Mia, that's very nice, but people want to only hear from their friends on social media. They do not want to hear from the government." But to that I say to you, just have a look at what the most mentioned topics are on platforms like Facebook. So in 2013, the most mentioned word on Facebook was the word vote, because we had the federal election and people were talking about the election and getting news about the election via platforms like Facebook. In the US last year, the term government shutdown was the second most talked about topic. In 2013, when the census ran, it was the third most talked about topic on Facebook. So just think about that last dinner party that you went to or the last barbecue. Invariably, the issues of government and politics and what people think the government should or shouldn't be doing come up in conversation, because what do people talk about with their friends? They talk about current events and they talk about their opinions about things to do with the things that matter to them, which includes all of the government programs that you're running, because the work that you do does actually touch the lives of the public. It might not touch them all on one night like the census does, but it does touch them throughout the course of their day and throughout the various services and programs that you're doing. So I think increasingly when you're working in government and you're trying to think about how you get your messages out, you need to think about what it looks like in someone's newsfeed on a phone. Sometimes I think we painstakingly create these very lengthy reports and then you put it up as a PDF document on the website and do a media release and think, I've done it, you know, it's out there, people will see it now. But are people really going to be clicking through to go through a really lengthy report on their phone on the bus in the morning? Can you distill that out into small infographics that are really light on text so that they look really good on your phone? And that brings me to one little issue. I know we're going to talk about a couple of different things, but I just wanted to finish up on the little issue of access to social media within government departments. I find it really interesting. So the McKinsey released a report about the social economy, and they found that social technologies are going to add around $900 billion to $1 trillion in value to the global economy, just because it's a real-time information loop. It can increase the productivity of white-collar workers in terms of being able to really quickly get information and share ideas. It's a really great way to get customer feedback and public feedback immediately. And then even yesterday we had the ACMA release a report about small businesses and found that a majority of small businesses are setting up Facebook pages if they are using social media at all, just because it's free, it's easy, and they can really easily update it, unlike a website. And so then I find it really intriguing when frequently in government departments access to social media is blocked because it's perceived to be a waste of time. If McKinsey and small businesses can see that there is economic benefit there, and if you can really understand something like social media by doing it a lot, I wonder if we should be thinking about how to empower public servants to be using social media a little bit better so that they can also be getting some of the benefits. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I guess Mia's good, given a good foundation there about what's going on. I guess, you know, for me, it's all about how do you actually personalise that what's actually happening and the transformation that's going on at the moment. And it always makes me think of the first time I took my children up to their grandmother's house and they saw her collection of LPs. And she had an old player and she had, you know, storybook style piece for the kids and that sort of thing. And the kids looked at them and said, what are they? And we said, well, you know, you can use them to play sound and music and things like that. And they said, oh, they're big CDs. And that's how they've referred to them ever since, is their LPs to them are big CDs. Now, my kids are now 15 and 17. They've grown up in a world with the internet. They don't know the world without the internet. And they're not the only ones. Over half Australia's population now has been born in the internet era. And there's a fundamental difference in the way you think and the way you actually act, depending on when you were born and what technologies you grew up with. I remember travelling overseas over to Europe in 1992. And at that time, you know, I didn't have access to bank accounts when I was over in Britain. To call home was a very expensive phone call, or, you know, sending letters taking 6 weeks. I had one situation where I was using my credit card and I wanted to put payments down on it because I was working over there, and they wouldn't accept payments in the UK. I had to send payments back to Australia as a cheque to then be submitted to my Visa card. And so I did that, but when the cheque got to Australia, they said, no, we can't accept that, it's a UK cheque. So it got sent back around the world to me again. And the ease at which you can travel today, and you're always connected to your, you know, your bank accounts, to your friends, to your family, and people are live blogging their trips and showing you the photos in real time. So, which is fortunate, no more slideshows when you get home. But the fact is that this has fundamentally changed the way people operate in society. They expect things to just work. They expect things to be very, very easy, very transparent. They expect to be able to carry around a device with more processing power than the rockets that took astronauts to the moon. And that has changed what we expect of the public service and of our government and of businesses. And that really puts a lot of, I suppose, pressure onto to those organisations to actually adapt the way they operate to deal with the technologies of the day. And part of it is also in the staff that are being employed in the public service. These days, it's about 75% of adult Australians use social media of one form or another. So that essentially translates to 75% of the staff of public servant agencies use social media. And whether they're just using it simply to connect to their children, or whether they're using it to run and coordinate groups, or to actually comment on the events of the day, they're engaging, they're using it, and they're becoming more and more active in different ways. So the challenge really has been for the public service, and I've sort of lived through part of this as well, is how does it actually normalise the behaviour of public servants in their apolitical, their very strict guidance on how they behave and how they're seen, and how do they actually merge that into a world where everybody can say whatever they think whenever they want to, and that, of course, leads to a lot of people saying things much faster than they, you know, than they intend. They don't think about it as much. And if you actually look at my Twitter feed, I've actually used myself as a bit of an example over the last 2 days and had a flame war with someone just to show how easy it is to step into a position where you can turn from what can be a civil discussion into an uncivil one and starts crossing the boundaries. And I think this is one of the real challenges at the moment. And the public service is dealing with this, and private enterprise is struggling with this as well, both from a sort of a legalistic perspective. There was someone at the ATO who got in quite a bit of trouble for doing a lot of abusive behaviour online towards a minor Australian celebrity. It also raises issues of apolitical conduct and how people actually engage on issues of the day. We do have guidelines in place across every public service in Australia. They do go quite a long way, in which they basically say that, you know, harsh and, you know, extreme comments about any elected politician, about any government policy, can actually be seen as a breach of the code of conduct. And that's problematic in a way, because there are very few aspects of life that government policies don't touch on. And there are discussions going on all the time that people often feel, you know, they have something to say because they know what's going on, or they've got a more experienced perspective and they want to contribute, but they also feel constrained by the guidance. It raises a lot of issues for people who have, you know, Centrelink situations or child support situations or transportation issues or other things. Is what they can they say and what can't they say? Are they actually constrained more than other citizens? And if so, is that constraint appropriate or is it too far? And I guess that's one of the things we're struggling with at the moment in the public service. The guidelines went in at first in 2010, and they basically were saying don't comment on the policy areas you were dealing with in sort of that extreme and harsh way, but it's now on anything, and that makes it a lot harder. So I do know a lot of public servants who've either retreated from social media or who've basically gone into hiding. And from some of the departments I talk to, there's almost a don't ask, don't tell policy in place, where, you know, you have anonymous accounts, you say what you think is important and you contribute in the ways you feel is right, but you don't actually declare that it's you or that it's connected or connected to the work you're doing, because then that might cause you to fall foul of some of the code of conduct. And I guess, you know, this is all an intermediate stage. We're still figuring out where social media fits in to our society, and we're still dealing with the changes that are happening in society. You know, Victoria has been discussing how it changes some of the sex abuser laws around who it puts on sex abuser lists, so that it stops catching, you know, 15 and 16-year-olds who tweet suggestive or semi-naked photos to their boyfriends and girlfriends and then instantly get put on the sex offenders list for 10 years. you know, there's discussions going on also in Victoria with Uber, which is, you know, which is threatening to basically change the way the entire commercial transport industry works, taking things out of the hands of taxi drivers and putting them in the hands of any driver who has a spare seat, who can basically, it's carpooling for money. And these things are going to continue to flow through the system, and it's going to take years for us to find the balances that actually fit, that suit a public service and suit a society. And through that process, things will change. The public service will change some of the way it operates, and we already see it changing some of its expenditure on communications campaigns and recruitment and in other areas where that's moving more to online and less to traditional, though the public sector still is puts a much lower expenditure on digital and social promotion and communications than do other mediums. Than do other industries. And I think we're all living through this massive experiment. So it's right to feel a little bit uncertain about what's going to go on and what's going to happen in the future, because there is no one who can say what the world's going to be like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years' time. We don't even know if the UK is going to be one country in 2 weeks' time. So I suppose what I'm trying to get to is that social media is profoundly changing the way our society operates. It is changing the way individuals associate with each other, how they discover information, how they form into groups and advocate for change, and it's changing the relationship between public servants and citizens, though not as quickly as probably I would like to see it happen at this stage. But more and more, you know, for a public service to be resilient into the future, it needs to ensure that it's well-trained and well-equipped to use these channels, that people are experienced, know how to use them effectively and successfully to promote the government's agenda, to be able to debate policy proposals, to consult people and to involve people in the process of governance, because it affects all of us. It's not just a once every 4 year thing. So in conclusion, your lives are not being made easier by social media. They're being made harder, and they're going to keep getting a little bit harder. But it's a good form of hard, because what it allows us to do is to more effectively engage with the people we need to engage with, to find the views, the experts outside our institutions that basically have more of the pieces of the solution than often the organisations do today. And throughout all of it, there is really a requirement that public servants are active both officially through their agency and personally as citizens and as educated participants in the debate that is our democracy into the future. So, thank you.
Yesterday at 22 minutes past two, or 1422 as I referred to it for the first 22,000 years of my military career, I tweeted about our decision to use the firm Acquia to provide the government content management system. That tweet got 1,148 impressions in the first 24 hours. 35 people clicked on the links, 18 people retweeted it. It's in about five online IT news articles today that the distribution of this comment has gone around very, very quickly in the little niche world of IT that I look after. And this has been a great advantage to us, because once upon a time, to get that level of coverage, we would have had to go through about seven or eight iterations of a media release planning document. We would have had to get potentially a minister or the department secretary to sign off on it. We would have had to go through all sorts of release strategies and all sorts of things like that. Instead, we wrote a blog post. We released the blog post and I tweeted about it. And next thing you know, it's in the news about what it is that we're doing. What that has changed in the context of our dealing with communications and getting our message across is that no longer is there a middleman who's interpreting our message to our audience. Instead, we're delivering it directly to the audience. So if you look at the online news articles, the online IT news articles about that media release, what you'll actually see is our words actually cut into the article exactly, because they don't have time to do an interpretation. They don't have time to spin it, because if they don't get the article out quickly, no one will want to read it, because they'll already have seen it by following the Twitter feed, by clicking on what it is that we actually posted about it immediately. We're now the source of the news, not necessarily the subject of the news. And this has been a considerable change in the way that we have used social media. Now, of course, my division, our department, isn't alone in this area. There are some 136 official federal government Facebook pages. DFAT alone has 40 such pages. Together, those 136 pages have some 9 million likes. Interestingly enough, 6 million of them are for the Tourism Australia page. There are 192 official government Twitter accounts that have collectively 1 million followers. In August, 12,000 tweets were sent out on those accounts, 32,000 retweets occurred, and 24,000 people favourited those tweets. What you can see is that social media is mainstream in the public service now. I would respectfully disagree with my colleagues on the panel, because I think we've actually seen over the last 5 years very considerable adoption of social media for a whole range of useful reasons. There are about 30 official government blogs. There are about 58 government YouTube channels and some 24 government Flickr channels. That distribution of information has changed considerably over the last few years. People are using social media to go about doing their government business all the time. And there are a range of use cases that you see being utilised by departments using social media. Hank Yongan, the spokesman for DHS, uses his Twitter account to say where he'll be to conduct face-to-face discussions with their clients. People in DHS participate on Facebook discussions to make sure people have the right advice about maternity entitlements, about vaccination entitlements. Those sorts of things are already happening. People put out consultation on the cloud. In our current work on a cloud service on social media, in our current work on the cloud services panel, we've put out not just the draft statement of requirement, but the draft contract. We've had some 34 serious levels of responses to that, some 418 separate comments about how we can improve the draft work that we're doing. This has changed the way that we do procurement, because once upon a time, the probity advisors would tell us, you can either tell everybody everything or nobody anything. And I've got up at events like this, industry briefs, where I've essentially said, nothing I'm going to say is of any importance because we didn't write it down and distribute it to you first. We're over that now because social media allows us to get out and tell anybody who wants to listen everything about what it is that we're doing. And we can now get far better consultation as a consequence of that. We can comment on social media pages, on online pages, and correct faults. Everyone knows that everywhere on the internet, someone is saying the wrong thing about the government all the time, and we've now got an opportunity to do something about that, to correct factually, politely, sensibly, responsibly, errors that don't explain how things have been done properly or where the actual right advice is. This has changed the way we connect to the citizens, to the clients that we have in organisations, to drive different behaviours, to get better results. Now, there is, as you heard, online policy about online comments. The policy about online comments is actually exactly the same as the policy about offline comments. Public comment, there is a policy about that. Frankly, I don't find that at all surprising. If you work for an organisation, there are things that you have to do as being part of that organisation. 22,000 years in the army taught me that. The challenge I think that we have to deal here is with something that's really not that hard to understand. Don't say stupid stuff. You know, that's really all it is. You wouldn't do it on the bus. You wouldn't do it at the barbecue. Don't say it online either. Make those appropriate understandings of what it is that you can do. But millions of people are using social media, as you heard, all the time. We don't need, I don't think, additional training to do that. Nor do we expect that everyone in the public service needs to be a spokesman for their organisation. Yes, many of them need to deal with customers and clients, and they do that every day across the counter without anything like the difficulties that people imagine. I know from talking to my colleagues in the Australian Public Service Commission that a very small percentage, less than single digits or less, that they get of code of conduct investigations have anything to do with an initial problem caused by social media. It isn't that big an issue for us. It's changing the way we do things, and that's a good thing, but it isn't driving those sorts of differences anymore. You've also heard, and I know this has been a constant concern, that people aren't allowed to use social media at work. So I find this a little problematic, because if everyone's using their phones to make social media, to use social media, and people aren't walking up and down the cubicles making sure you're not using your phone, how do they know you're not using social media? Of course people can use social media at work now. Some can do it officially as part of their work, and the State of the Service report discusses each year how many people are doing that, and it's growing considerably. But people can also do it personally all the time. And indeed they do. And indeed they don't get into trouble all the time. They can tweet, they can use Facebook, they can do things just as they can text their friends, as long as what they're doing primarily at work is their job. And I don't find that's all that surprising either. Yes, it's changing. Social media is changing the way that we've done things. But to my mind, social media is about a journey. It's not about a destination. There's not some social media nirvana that we're all trying to reach. It's just a different tool for communicating in different ways. Some of us are relaxed about standing up in front of audiences and talking. Some people would rather not do that. Some people will be spokesmen for their agencies on social media. Some people won't. As long as you remember simple rules about not saying stupid stuff, it's pretty easy to get by in this social media world. Thanks.
Thanks, John and Craig and Mia. We'll just have a quick panel discussion. We'll make sure we leave plenty of time for your questions at the end. I'd like to start, John, with your approach around the personal and the professional. You've got a very interesting situation in that you've got two accounts, one of which is government CTO and the other one is Shiro 24,000, I think.
Right. 58, yeah. Let's not get carried away.
I wonder how you go balancing between those two accounts, your personal and your professional. Does there ever a bleed into each other?
I try not to do that. Generally speaking, what I try to do is I usually use my personal account most of the time. The things that I'm talking about there are often related to the things that I do professionally at work and things that we do at work. But if I want to make really official announcements, I'll tend to do that on the CTO account. But most of the time, I'll engage on my personal account. That's also the account that I tweet about rugby union, for those of you who have been sort of gone through that exercise. It's almost over, don't worry, at least for the year. I also put up posts, slides that I've done and things like that. Generally speaking, I think using the personal account is fine. In my case, though, it doesn't make an enormous amount of difference, because there's no way I could defend an adverse comment that I made on my personal account on the basis that it was my personal account, not my work account. That would be a very false sort of explanation to be trying working. People know who you are. You know, despite what you might think, there's no anonymity on the internet. People can always find out who you are eventually. So that distinction is really one about making official statements versus the normal discussion. But I don't think I'm hiding behind that personal account at all.
No. I think a lot of people, when they look at social media policy, though, would say that they're just purely in the personal or in a private space. But, Craig, do you think that's ever possible? Do you agree that, you know, you can't ever really be anonymous online?
I think, by and large, you know, you actually only have the illusion of anonymity online. Like, it's quite a good illusion, and a lot of people get taken in by it. Even when they're using their real name, they often say things that they wouldn't say face-to-face. And people often get in trouble for doing that. We see celebs getting caught out quite regularly, and we see just private individuals being pulled up on things they say as well. So, but, you know, for the most part, most people are not important enough for anybody to go to the effort to find out who they are if they're using a pseudonym. So at that point, it really gets down to your own personal choice as to whether, you know, you're welcome to attach statements to your own name or whether you prefer to, you know, hide them behind some sort of, nickname or other thing. But it's really, you know, fundamentally, there is no privacy anymore, guys. Sorry if you thought there were, but we actually lost our privacy some time ago. But it's basically a collective illusion that we like to maintain.
Mia, on Facebook, there's the opportunity to set up private networks and do things like that. Mm-hmm. People often say that they're just commenting privately about their organisation within a closed group. Is that true, or do those comments also end up appearing elsewhere on the web?
So on Facebook, you can either choose to do friends only or public. Personally, I do both, so I comment on sort of general things publicly, and then I keep the kid photos and, you know, the boring sort of things about what I'm up to and eating for lunch private to just my friends. But you do run the risk, as you, even if you're just sharing with friends, that your friends might be friends with somebody else, or they might sort of see it in a different context, and people can always screenshot something. I mean, even things that disappear very quickly. I mean, the Anthony Weiner tweet, for example, of the photo, the infamous photo that ruined his career, that was only up online for a matter of seconds, and he deleted it. Even Justin Bieber these days is, you know, posting photos on Instagram and deleting them, but he's still getting media coverage from them. So even friends only or deleting things still doesn't necessarily mean that somebody else didn't get a screenshot of that. So it is important to make sure that you're getting the benefits out of social media to also be thinking about what you're posting, and to also think about just before you post, what is there another light that I could see this in, and could someone take a screenshot of that and then use that to kind of try to challenge your position.
I think perhaps some of the other comments that we had in the introductory space there, people were saying that that this is really a form of media that we haven't really had access to before, you know, whether it's for good, as John's saying, to, you know, put out messages about government, but also you've got access to a large audience, and it's being conscious of that audience. The barbecue comment now can be amplified, you know, out to anyone. So I wonder if that's something that we should be teaching our staff about, John, in the public service, if we should be saying you need to have more of that awareness of digital citizenship and how much a comment can be amplified.
So I think there's an opportunity to educate people via policy and things like that. But I think people tend to sadly underestimate the intelligence of public servants, the way that they go about doing their everyday business all the time. I don't think they need to be led by the hand. I don't think it's necessary to treat them all like their children. 13 million using Facebook, 9 million all the time, 2 million, I think 2.5 million Australians tweeting all the time. People know how to do this stuff. Occasionally they need a bit of reminder. And yes, there's policy that tells them what to do, but I don't think we need to treat them like children. They're grown-ups, they can understand what happens, and they can appreciate the consequences.
Look, I have a slightly different view. I think there are about 12 million car drivers in Australia, but there are probably only a couple of hundred who can actually drive an F1. And I think it's a very different looking at, you know, using these channels personally. Yep, people can go for it. They can talk about whatever they like. They can conduct their relationships online, put photos online, do all those sort of things. But when it comes to actually doing these things in a more professional sense or an official sense for an agency, I think there is, some requirement to actually help people acquire the skills necessary for that task. It is a new medium. It is a new body of work. Public servants are very intelligent. They're also extremely busy, and they're becoming busier and busier as there's fewer and fewer of them. So they don't necessarily have the time to commit to becoming an expert in another topic or another area as well. So, you know, providing training is basically a shortcut to expertise. So giving them the ability of training and support to actually lift their level of engagement, I think, is important. And the other thing I think is, I think we have higher standards for our public service than we expect from the man on the street. And I like to think that we try and maintain higher standards overall. And of course you get the occasional, you know, lower standard here and there. But I think overall, you know, we should be trying to actually equip public servants with a higher capability to use these channels to the benefit of the government of the day and to the benefit of our democracy and our public engagement than simply saying, yep, they use it in their personal lives, they'll be fine, we'll just let them do whatever they want.
So there needs to be some support around bringing people into social media. I think recently the ATO opened up its social media policy a little bit more and said that staff could have some involvement with social media at work. And, you know, moving from that space of being a personal user to using it in more of a professional capacity. Taxation Commissioner Chris Jordan actually said, I encourage you to think about how these tools can help you do your job as we continue to evolve the way we do business with our clients and with each other. So I think there's a move towards using social media more. I'm wondering if you could all give us a bit of an example of how you think the public service could be engaging more through social media in a professional capacity.
I'll start off. I've probably got a couple of examples. I mean, I think one way is as that really effective feedback loop. I mean, I think we're increasingly seeing, particularly, say, in the telecommunications and the airline and the banking industry, that, you know, people are using social media sort of as an increased way of dealing with what they would otherwise be using through a call centre. You know, people can post questions like, what time are you open? Where can I get this service? Where is this piece of information? The Department of Immigration, I think it's got renamed, so I apologise if I haven't correctly named them, but, you know, they often use their Facebook page for exactly that. People will post factual questions and they will provide factual responses. Another way is to think about using it in consultations. South Australia government did a great way of consulting for a policy document that they wanted to develop a strategic plan for the state. And again, rather than put this, you know, 50-page document up and say, you know, please find the questions at the end, they actually drip-fed the questions out through their Facebook page and sort of said, like, so here's one issue, here's one issue, here's one issue, and got the feedback that way. So I think there are lots of different ways that you can use it as that two-way communication. And then, of course, you know, you've got people like the ABS and the ACMA who will release, you know, updated stats and information with a really great image and just a sort of a small bit of information with the ability to click through and learn more. So there's ways that you can use it to get the information out there, but also to engage in that two-way conversation. Craig is an expert and has a day job in consulting on this, so your examples.
Yeah, look, I agree with everything Mia was saying, and John was talking about a lot of this, you know, when he spoke earlier as well. I think the other area to always keep in mind is that public servants can use social media effectively to actually engage with each other. And you can use it to foster collaboration within agencies and across agencies. We're seeing more agencies starting to implement things like innovation systems to collect and rate and discuss ideas and actually take them through a process to look at improvements for the agency or for identifying issues that need to be addressed internally. It's being used to work more closely with stakeholders and other governments around the world. And I think there is a really, there's a lot of value in using it to build some of those informal networks that, you know, public servants don't have the time to go along to a meeting every week or every couple of weeks. And social media can help bridge at least some of that gap by keeping that sharing collaboration working.
I don't think there are enough pictures of cats to distribute more of those. I think all of these are good ideas, and I think we're increasingly using those all the time. And thinking of new ways to do this is also something that we can be engaged in. A couple of, if you like, balancing things. We need to understand that an internet poll or a poll on social media isn't the same as a real poll because it's a self-inclusion mechanism. People are more likely to complain when they comment than they are to say nice things. So you've got to balance that sort of arrangement. We've had some wonderful discussions about, in the arcane world of IT, about differences between platforms, Drupal versus WordPress, Microsoft Office versus open document formats. You can get enormous discussion wound up about those. But is it consequential, I think, is the interesting challenge. You have to pick your target. I don't think we could sensibly use social media for a discussion on immigration policy, for example. I just don't think that would work. But we can get useful consultation about procurement policy, because we do get people involved in doing that. So it's a question of just balancing what it is that you want to do, recognising the sort of feedback that you're getting, and choosing the target. Social media, I think, is a channel, a tool, as part of a very considered communications strategy that you might have. I'm against the notion of just having a social media strategy. My view is that just as carpenters don't have hammer strategies, that you don't need a particular tool strategy for a strategy for a particular tool, but rather you should look at your broad communication strategy and adopt the channels that you need to use for the right purpose. Don't hit the screws with the hammer. Don't try and drill things in with the hammer either.
It's interesting, actually. A lot of people isolate social media in a specific role or in a specific department or something like that, when I think social media will become something that works across a number of roles in the public service and isn't, you know, sort of one person's job. It sort of belongs to a few people. I think that's what you're saying when you're saying it's part of a communications plan. You know, when we stop sort of worrying about the individual channels and we start thinking about the message that we want to put on them. Craig, I think you had a comment there as well.
Well, yeah, I always say it's a horizontal skill set, it's not a vertical skill set. But I think it starts as a vertical, just like we start other things at a vertical. First, the only people who know anything about procurement are the procurement team. But eventually, everybody who does any procurement has to understand enough about procurement in order to do what they need to do to actually, you know, procure things. So social media is going to be the same way. It will be a horizontal skill, because even if you're not empowered to officially speak on behalf of the agency, you might find that, you know, the stakeholders and activists that you're monitoring and that you're engaging with are using social channels, and you want to monitor what they're saying. Your customers might be talking about, like Therapeutic Goods Administration. A few years ago, I was talking to them about monitoring social media to actually get reportings of issues with therapeutical goods before it actually came through the quite slow and cumbersome complaint process that a lot of people won't use. So there's lots of places across the public service where social media can have a positive impact. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be talking on social media to achieve that. Often a lot of it is actually listening.
And I think a lot of those roles are evolving into roles about training or about talking to people about how they can use social media in their role more rather than just focusing on being the messenger. I wonder if you've got any other experiences of that.
I think from my time with working within the government, I think and also then working with a lot of different agencies and businesses, I think social media tends to work best for an organisation if there is sort of buy-in by everybody in the organisation in it, because it's about spotting, for the official channels, spotting the different aspects where you can be posting or tweeting about those particular things. Just having one person who maybe doesn't know everything that's going on or isn't, in the bigger strategy meetings, and having them sort of isolated as sort of this, add-on at the bottom, like, oh, that's right, social media is a little tick the box at the bottom. That's not going to work as effectively as when everybody feels like it is part of their responsibility. Mm.
That's certainly been a change. I think the web's the same thing. It's also been included at the bottom, but eventually it works into a core part of people's strategies. We might open up to some questions now. There are some roving microphones. Could you hold one of those up there and one just over here? We do have a little bit of a rule with questions that they are, 1 to 2 sentences, often finishing with a question mark. The other things are called statements, and as we said before, put those on Twitter and, we'd love to hear from you. Some of them could even be blog posts. If you just want to raise your hands and our volunteers will find you. If there are any questions?
Hi, Lenore from the Department of Industry. Craig, you mentioned internal collaboration sites, where we're building one at the moment for the division. Top tips, or what are, here comes the question, what would be your top tip or a couple of top tips on encouraging staff to engage and collaborate in an internal work site?
Well, I think the first step is to make sure you've got the full process thought out and structured to begin with. I've seen situations where agencies say, yeah, yeah, it'd be a great idea to collect staff question ideas, and then we'll put them in some kind of process and have some come out the other end. And they don't, and they set up the front end of the process, but they don't do enough thinking about how they're actually going to review those ideas, how often they're going to do it, what are the criteria and the hurdles they've got to pass to actually, you know, step through into, you know, prototyping, piloting, implementing. So I think it's very important to have the full process mapped out, to communicate it very clearly to people and say that this is how it's going to work. And then you have to stick to it. And that involves getting senior management championing the process, someone being responsible for and accountable and taking ownership of it and being a champion at senior levels so that it doesn't get lost in the wash of other priorities that you have as an agency. The actual system, you know, a lot of people go to the technology first and they say, oh, let's find a great ideation system. You know, we've got a system for that. It's being used by IOP Australia. There are other people with systems. The system, the technology itself is the last thing you should look at. You should really make sure that you've actually got the process right and the human elements right. And I'm talking to the ACT government about this, and a lot of the areas where I find innovation systems in governments fall down is also that individual public servants don't necessarily have the skills to take an idea from inception through to implementation. They have part of those skills, but often their focus is in other things, and they've got a job, and they've got other things they have to do as well. So there's a lot of value in bringing in some startup expertise or some expertise around people who can mentor or help public servants in actually taking ideas throughout that whole process. Because essentially what you're doing is a startup within an agency, is the way I look at it. And that's a particular skill set, and it is pretty rare.
Any other questions? One just there.
I just had I'm from the National Library. I just had a question. Somebody commented, I think it was you, Craig, that more than half of Australia's population are engaging in social media. That follows that nearly half of Australia's population are not engaging through social media. And I'm just worried if there's a danger that the people who are not engaging in social media are going to get left behind or become the new silent minority whose voices are not getting heard.
Do you want to take that?
I mean, I can answer a little bit of that. I mean, I think we're still seeing growth, number one. Number two, part of that half are also under 13. So, you know, they're children. And so if you actually look at it in terms of people who are able to buy their own phones and manage their own accounts, it is like a very large proportion of the, you know, sort of adult online population. But having said that, I think you've got a very valid concern. But I think also, like, the way I sort of think about social media is it's the power of word of mouth at scale. So it's technology-enabled word of mouth. And you should also remember the power of word of mouth offline of things that other people see online. So one person can have a Facebook account and see something and then be talking about it offline as a power of word of mouth as well. So I think there still are connections between networks. It's just working now online and offline. But I don't know if you have other thoughts on that.
Yeah, I can add to that. But it's about 75% of the adult population, which is the way I try and look at it. Because with kids, obviously there's a demographic who's busy using iPads but isn't really interested in social media yet. And then you have at the other end of the scale, people who tend to be aged above the age of retirement tend to be less likely to use these channels, and that grows increasingly. And, you know, we have lots of nursing homes in this country, and many of them don't even have an internet connection available for the residents. So there's still a lot of issues at that end of the scale as well. But what you find is that, you know, you're looking at 90% plus of people aged between 18 and 45 these days. Yes, definitely there is an issue with the people who are not on the internet becoming marginalised. But as Mia said, they definitely are still connected because they're all connected. Most of them are connected to people who are connected. When we had all the Queensland floods and tsunamis going through, and Queensland Police was doing a great job on Facebook and Twitter, their Facebook and Twitter messages weren't just reaching people using those mediums. They were being read out on ABC radio regionally. They were being put into newspapers. They were being shared amongst the people with internet connections in the town with the people who didn't. So just because it's on social media doesn't mean it doesn't have a real-world halo footprint. It's the difference between, you know, readership and circulation. And we don't really, we're not really keeping track of it for social media. But there's definitely a need to still maintain contact with people through other channels as well. Not only because some people don't use social media, but also for reinforcement purposes. And because sometimes other channels are better, such as that immigration discussion that John was talking about. So it is important. What we have is a multimedia landscape where there are different mediums you have to use, and it's no longer sufficient just to use your good old, you know, steak and three veg, TV, radio, newspapers, magazines. You know, you can't just use that anymore. You've got to use a whole range of ingredients to make up your media meals.
I think the interesting thing, of course, from the National Library's point of view, is that other 50% of the people who are still reading books, so you want to keep them online together if you can as well. I think one of the interesting phenomenon we see is how many people do more than one thing at once with social media. So the number of people who are watching television at night but sitting on social media and the effect that that has. So those, that combining of channel messages is still working together to make sure we reach audiences. I must admit that I'm more concerned about the people who are not connected, not through choice, but through a digital divide sort of challenge, and where those people are getting information from and how we might be addressing those needs. I think one of the things that using social media channels has enabled government service delivery agencies to do is to recognise that delivering through that social media channel can often be cheaper than delivering through the more historic channels that they've used, and that can free up resources to devote to those people on the wrong side of the digital divide where they need that additional caring or information or those sorts of things. So I think, yes, there's something to be concerned about there, but I think it allows us to consider how we can move resources to deal with things where the most need occurs. I am, of course, taken by the fact that given the smartphone penetration in Australia and what we see in countries like India and in continents like Africa, where the penetration of mobile communications is actually greater than the penetration of fresh water, those sorts of things. And I think we are seeing a considerable change in how people use that level of communication.
Funny you should mention the National Library and the 50% of people who are still reading books. We've got great challenges around digitising our collection, and the next digital culture talk we'll be doing in this series will be talking about where the book went next, what the format of the book is beyond the print. We've probably got time for just one more question. If you've been desperate to ask a question, now is the time. Just down the front here, maybe.
My name is Alan. I work for the Department of Finance, and my question is to all three of you, and that is, what can agencies do to push down the permission for people to engage on social media professionally and even in an official capacity?
So let me kick off. What should we do to push down permission? I'm still on the idea of not everyone needs to be a spokesman for a spokesperson for the agency. And I think that's the first thing. People who are comfortable with doing something should be encouraged to do it, but I don't think there's a need to force people who don't want to do that. Certainly you do need a bit of top cover as we still work through new ideas in these areas. But I think some of this percolates generally pretty slowly all the time. About 11,000 years ago in the army, we first had
moved on from that.
Yeah, exactly. We first had we needed to get permission to make long distance phone calls and get them logged. I see some nodding around the audience and people who are also thousands of years old. That moved on. It changed. And I think that's going to change in social media terms as well. This will, I'm quite sure, appear a very quaint discussion when you know, in 5 or 10 years' time, people won't understand why we were talking like that. Just as when I say STD phone call now, a lot of people think it's about some sort of disease.
Could I say, sorry, just around spokespeople, I think there's a real role for people who work for organisations to be advocates as well. Whilst they might not be official spokespeople, they can talk about their work and what they do. I think as an employee of a cultural organisation, I think that's especially important for people who work for cultural organisations and want to be part of a cultural dialogue. Sorry, Craig.
Yeah, I agree that definitely time is probably the main factor. As we keep being told, something like, you know, 80% of the SES are retiring in the next 5 years.
I'm not. I've got 22,000 more years.
John, they can't let you retire. The payout will be too much. But, but I think, you know, that what we're already seeing and what I've definitely seen over the last 5 or 6 years, because we have been having this same conversation since at least 2007, that I recall, I've been asked this question, is that increasingly we're seeing, you know, people who are coming into the senior echelons of the public service who have grown up with the internet, who have understand it, who use it themselves, and for whom it's now normal and it's not something strange and different and invasive and potentially, you know, threatening or dangerous because they don't fully understand it. So, you know, and also there's an education process that's been going on as well. You know, older people are increasingly adopting social channels because they're finding the uses for it that actually suit what they want to do. You know, the particular sports they're interested in or the you know, whatever topics that they like to follow, they're finding that social is increasingly a way for them to actually access what they're seeking to access. And that helps normalise it within an organisation, so, and helps provide the permission downwards. I think the largest factor right now is actually not in the public sector. I think it's actually in the political arm, where there has been a bit of a backward step towards being open and transparent about a lot of areas. And that has made a lot of public servants, even senior ones, take a bit of a back step from their level of engagement. And that's a temporary thing. It will pass. And progressively as we go forward, you know, we'll take 2 steps forward, 1 step back, and it will keep on going, and we'll get there to a point where people within agencies feel comfortable engaging at least personally on social media and understand the boundaries. But I think it will just take time.
My one suggestion would be to engage in internal storytelling. Sometimes social media, to those people within an organisation who are not there, is an invisible world. Surfacing that and bringing it to be visible to the rest of the organisation is a great way to help get people thinking about how to sort of push down those permissions that you mentioned. So, you know, one example is, you know, when you do your annual reports, you probably write how many, you know, ministerials you do or how many public queries you do. Do you explain how many page likes you have, how many comments, what your engagement rate is, what your reach is, all of that kind of stuff? I mean, taking, you know, what was your most popular post or tweet for the week and put that somewhere internally in the organisation so people can see it, so they can feel that feedback loop and see the value that's coming from there. Are there stories within your portfolios where, I mean, I have a tracker on the word Facebook for mentions within Parliament, and it's quite phenomenal the number of people, MPs who are getting feedback from their constituents via sites like Facebook. So trying to showcase that and make that visible and real, I think then helps get buy-in on the value of it, which then makes people understand more about why everybody should be empowered to be participating in that space.
Great. All right, please join me in thanking our speakers today, John Sheridan, Craig Tomler and Mia Garlick. Thank you.